Welcome to this special edition of the Huffites Institute's weekly audio podcast. You're hearing an audio-only portion from the Huffites Discussion. The Huffites Discussion is where we bring leaders in sports medicine and human performance together, give them the microphone for 15 minutes, and have them tell us their big ideas. As I said, you're listening to the audio-only portion. You can go to the website for the Huffites Institute at huffitesinstitute.org and get the full video and check out the speakers' bios. We'll be putting a new one up every 2 weeks. So thank you for downloading us, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy. Our speaker this week is Michael Davis, who is a faculty member at Oklahoma State University. Dr. Davis is a veterinarian and has a PhD in physiology. He's received over $5 million in research funding to study the effects of exercise stress in animal models, particularly in racing sled dogs. The title of his talk today is The Art and Science of Fatigue, Proof.
It's on. Class of 88, howdy. Thank you. Thank you. I've been gone a little while. I've been sort of relocated, exiled to the state to the north. Yeah, I know. But I still annoy them greatly every time y'all come to town. We all have a concept in our minds of what fatigue proof is. It's all based on our own individual experiences. A couple hundred people watching, a couple of hundred different definitions, and that's fine. But I think most of y'all are reasonable, and most reasonable people would agree that if you can do 38 marathons back-to-back, nonstop, in 9 days, that would be a pretty good definition of fatigue proof, don't you think? I want you to meet Maggie and Marge. Maggie and Marge are litter mates. There was also Bart. There was also Homer. They are racing Alaskan sled dogs. They're cute. They're cuddly. They're very friendly. But more to the point, they are capable of running 38 marathons back-to-back in 9 days. They are the epitome of fatigue proof. So for the next few minutes, I'm going to give you a little bit of background of what we've learned from these remarkable athletes and where what we learn from them is eventually going to be taking human performance. Come, there we go. So to talk about fatigue proof, we have to talk about exercise biochemistry, because basically exercise is converting chemical energy to mechanical energy. And so muscle cells are pretty complicated. Those of y'all that are taking notes, you got all this down? Okay, because it's going to be on the test. For those of you that don't have to worry about that, we're going to simplify it down. Really, the core processes that we have to worry about are very simple. We have to provide fuel. We have to burn the fuel. We have to get rid of the waste. And that's really all muscular work is. The faster we do that, the better we exercise. For the sake of this talk, we're going to even eliminate the bottom two. We're not going to worry about removal of waste. We're not going to worry about the machinery for converting chemical to mechanical energy. We're simply going to examine the provision of substrates, the fuel that we use for muscular work. And it's essentially oxygen and some oxidizable carbon-carbon bond. Maybe carbs, maybe fat, maybe protein, hopefully not too much protein. Carbs and fat are a lot easier and cheaper to feed, but we need to get oxygen and we need to get a carbon-carbon bond. We need to combine them, we need to oxidize the carbon-carbon bond, we harvest ATP, we undergo muscular work. Now, the dogs that we're talking about here are part of the population that runs the annual Iditarod sled dog race. And the Iditarod sled dog race had just completed its 40th running. It's sort of the art of fatigue proof. Trial and error, intuition, a lot of experience and a lot of failures and a lot of successes, but the folks that run this race have developed a phenotype. of fatigue proof. The Iditarod is 1,000 miles running from Anchorage to Nome. The last place team finished Sunday evening, this last Sunday evening, in about 14 and a half days. A 14 and a half day time would have won the first 7 races. The last decade, the race has come in under 9.5 days. The winner has finished in under 9.5 days for that 1,000 miles. So let me tell you a little bit about these dogs. First of all, they're not what you think. They're not what Disney has on the screen. These are small. Average size is only about 22 to 25 kilograms, or about 50 pounds. They're mutts. There's not a purebred dog in the front of this race. It's a simple feat of fast male, fast female, put them together. Hopefully you get fast babies. And we don't care what they look like, because the best looking dog in the world is the one that crosses the finish line first. They are aerobic monsters. They have an aerobic capacity. Thus far, we've not been able to fully measure it, but I can tell you that they put us to shame. You know, we have data from, there was some guy that won a bunch of Tour de France's some time back. An untrained sled dog has an aerobic capacity 2.5 times that guy. An untrained dog. A trained dog, we don't know what the top end is yet, but we do know that they will outstrip the best thoroughbred racehorses in the world on a pound-for-pound basis. Now, interestingly, come on, little clicker. There we go. That's not necessarily a unique feature of trained Alaskan sled dogs. We've been working a little bit with the Marine Corps with their explosive detection dogs, and what you see in the picture is an explosive detection dog named Green, not quite at the top end of his VO2 max, but he's going 14 miles an hour up a 14% grade, and we've got him up to about 230 mils per kilo per minute, or you know, about 3.5 times Tour de France cyclist. And we couldn't go any higher because somebody built the roof of the room too low. And if we tilted the treadmill anymore, we would have put it through the ceiling. Green was not at the top end of his capacity. So it's not really unique to sled dogs. Most athletic dogs can do this. What's unique for a sled dog is not the oxygen, but the carbon-carbon bonds that they can process. Over the course of a day, a racing sled dog, little 22 to 25 kilogram sled dog, will burn between 10 and 12,000 calories. And they can do that day after day after day. 10 to 12,000 calories. The Iditarod requires just a little bit over 100,000 calories to get from Anchorage to Nome. This is where dogs just leave, the trained Alaskan sled dogs leave everybody else behind. So how do we get that into the muscle? Well, it's something that they learn on the fly. Initially, they will use up their muscular reserves, just like any of us would do if we tried to do this. But what we found is that they will increase their ability to get things like glucose into the muscle on the fly while they run, so that they are replenishing their reserves as they run these types of races. Makes them virtually fatigue-proof. The key is to get it into the muscle, and that's where the limiting factor is. So we've done a little bit of work to figure out how to get it into the muscle. Now, it doesn't just diffuse into the muscle. It has to be transported, and so we have to provide a specific transporter. And for muscle, we're looking at a transporter called GLUT4. It's the one that everybody's been looking at. It's vitally important for muscle contraction, and it's a unique glucose transporter because it can be dynamically upregulated when you contract the muscle. It increases its ability to bring in glucose in response to a glucose-using process. So it didn't come as a great surprise to us that when you undergo aerobic conditioning, or when a sled dog undergoes aerobic conditioning, their basal ability to move glucose into the muscle increases. That's not a big shock. That's been demonstrated in a lot of species, including humans. What we recently found, though, is that the gain of the system that links contraction to glucose transport increases with conditioning, so that the same amount of contraction results in a greater amount of glucose transport into the muscle. The more you can use glucose coming from the bloodstream, instead of using the very finite reserves that you have in your muscle cell, the more fatigue-proof you're going to be. These dogs with conditioning are increasing their contraction-mediated glucose uptake by some sixfold. It's a massive increase, and it helps explain why they're able to burn 12,000 calories a day without using their intramuscular reserves. Well, I've been doing this with the sled dogs for about 10 years. And one thing that has become very, very predictable is just when we think that we're getting a handle on things, just when we're getting cocky enough to think that we've got this under control, we are smart, then the road skips out from underneath your tires. This was a government-owned vehicle, and it is totaled. I had had it for about 90 minutes. It was it had a very short but happy life. In order to just sort of cross the I's and dot the T's, we take the same samples that we've measured glucose transport, the ones that we've measured a six-fold increase in response to contraction, and we just measure the GLUT4 transporter. Well, what are we supposed to find? If there's six times the transport, there should be six times the transporters. Instead, we found a 40% decrease in transporters. And you would not believe how many times these samples and these data have been run, because that's not what we were expecting to find. But what we've had to come to grips with is the fact that what the dogs have done in order to facilitate this magnitude of exercise, and what is likely capable for humans if we can figure out the translation of art to science in fatigue-proof endurance exercise, is that there's a whole other transport system out there that has not been defined yet, but is massively capable of supporting exercise. You know, every turn, it sort of seems like, I feel like the dogs in this picture, you know, you have this vague idea of where you need to go. You can't really see where it is, but you just sort of, for lack of better options, you just keep moving forward. And I feel for these guys, because we're moving forward. I mean, the potential outcome here is so compelling that we have no choice but to keep moving forward. But we always have to worry about the fact that we've got these dogs sitting there looking at us, and they already know the answer. And they just kind of, every once in a while, turn their head and say, "So, what? You figured it out yet?" So thank you very much. And I'm not going to get tackled by Tim. I'm sorry. I know you were looking forward to it.
Nice picture. Yeah. We got several questions for you. First one comes from me, because okay. I've heard some of this stuff before. You said very early on that you couldn't measure, you haven't been able to yet measure the maximal oxygen consumption in these dogs. And now, as a scientist, we think we can measure everything, especially oxygen consumption, because we've all been doing this for a long time. Why haven't you been able to measure oxygen consumption in these dogs?
You know how hurdles come one at a time?
Sure.
Well, we're having to take them one at a time. Our first hurdle was the fact that, you know, the massive amount of metabolic output that sort of exercise represents is a lot of heat to dissipate in an animal that doesn't sweat. And so in order to do this without having your exercise limited by hyperthermia, we have to do it in single-digit temperatures. And so it took us a little while to design all the different equipment so that we could actually have functional equipment at single-digit temperatures and functional people at single-digit temperatures. Once we got that, and we did clear that hurdle, then we started running these dogs, and they started behaving metabolically against all the other paradigms. So right now, we can make estimates, but we're having to rethink a lot of the assumptions that have always gone into measuring VO2 max because, unfortunately, the dogs have thrown us a curveball and they're not adhering to those assumptions. So we have to sort of take a step back and figure out the way around that'll give us a valid number. I can pretty much assure you that we're well over 200 and probably well over 250 mils per kilo per minute, but my personal bet is that we're going to find a dog that can clear 300, but I'm not sure yet.
Wow, just an amazing performance. We got a question from Jordan S. That said, how are they fueling these dogs during these races since they use so many calories?
And that's a really good point and a really good question, and one that I have to sort of reiterate to a lot of the racers is that if you're going to burn 12,000 calories, you'd better eat 12,000 calories. Otherwise, you're not going to last. The diets that the dogs typically eat have to be very, very calorie dense because, you know, it's still only a 22 kilo dog, and so their stomach's only about this big. You're able to get, if you feed a high fat diet, about 60% fat calories and 20% carb, 20% protein, you can get about 3,000 calories per meal into that stomach without distending it too much. So you're basically stopping at least four times a day to feed them a very high fat, calorie rich, compact diet.
Wow, I've seen some where they like almost give them Crisco. Like,
yeah, I mean, there's some supplements called, it's essentially called premium fat, and it looks like yellow stringy Crisco. And fortunately, at single digit temperatures, it's pretty solid, and so you can just make little ice cream balls for the dogs and throw it to them, and it literally melts in their mouth. But it's a huge amount of calories and this nice little bite.
And they think it's a treat.
And they love it.
Yeah. Well. Last question from Sue B. here. How realistic is it to translate these findings to humans to minimize fatigue in athletes or soldiers?
The best answer I have for that goes back to our techniques. I mean, we're doing a lot of protein assays, a lot of Western blots and stuff like that. In every single case thus far, there's enough homology between the proteins that are involved in the energy management pathways of dog muscle with the comparable proteins in human muscle that we're using exclusively human-targeted monoclonal antibodies. In virtually all cases, we're talking about just a handful of amino acid differences between the dog enzyme and the human enzyme. So, no, there's not any guarantee that it will be translatable. But there's such a huge degree of homology in this specific system between human and dog that it's too close to not try.
Fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for your time today. Please join me in thanking Dr. Davis.
We want to thank you for downloading us and listening. And remember that you can go to our website at huffinesinstitute.org to download the full video podcast of all of these talks. We want to remind you that our institute and these podcasts are supported by the Huffines family and the Omar Smith family. We hope that you have an active and healthy week.